Good afternoon. I am presenting work that I did with my colleague, Patricia Ricker, at she's at Boston University and Harvard Medical School. And this is based on our book. The handout that's going around is a RAND fact sheet about the book. And I asked Chaque to hand it around because I'm not sure when we get to a slide showing the figure of the model. It's a lot easier if you have the image in hand. Our work was funded by a grant from the National Library of Medicine and a residency at the Rockefeller Center in Bellagio, Italy, and I thank them both. I didn't put in the slide saying I have no financial relationships to disclose, but I have no financial relationships to disclose, so thank you. As an overview of my talk today, I'm going to talk a little bit about why gender and health is a puzzle. And this is about understanding women's health. It's also about understanding men's health and how to intervene to improve both. What's missing from the current thinking on men's and women's health? Pat and I propose a framework of constrained choice to understand the barriers, the things that get in the way of pursuing health and maintaining health, and discuss implications of this framework for targeted interventions. Now, there's several questions to ponder as we start to talk about and think about men's and women's health. First is, are individuals who don't make health an everyday priority acting rationally? If we don't look far enough to understand the constraints on individuals' lives and the kinds of trade-offs they make, whether it's time trade-offs, financial trade-offs, paying for medicine or food for their children instead of for themselves, or other kinds of caregiving relationships, we're not going to understand how to intervene. And you'll fall back on the health beliefs models and other approaches. But unless you can understand the context that people are living in and what's actually getting in their way of making health a big enough priority that they act on it, you're not going to be able to intervene. Another question is, are there gender differences in the opportunities to choose health? Now, certainly there are many parts of the world where this is totally without question, where there are stark differences in the access to health care for men and women, in the opportunities they have, in the nutrition available. It gets more subtle as you look into other settings where we know that based on a history of medical research focused on men, on problems that are we now understand are common in women, there may be barriers to women's health in, for example, cardiovascular disease and some of the other work I've done. In Pat's work, looking at understanding testicular cancer and prostate cancer and other and especially problems less common in men like breast cancer, where there may be low awareness. Anytime you're appear to be or actually are in the minority, there's a risk of not understanding, your risk of not being recognized, of not being seen as the typical patient, if it comes to that, but are not necessarily recognizing what you might or could or should do to try to protect your health going forward. Finally, does understanding these constraints choices, these constraints, make a difference in how we intervene? And we argue that because so many of the decisions that affect an individual's opportunity to pursue a healthy life are made at levels of organization higher than the individual, at the level of the household, at the community, at the social policy level, at the workplace even, that unless we as researchers provide information about the health impact of making decisions, whether it's about transportation policy, the nutrition that's provided in the workplace, the impact of having good schools for children. If we don't make that health information available, then they're going to do their economic models deciding where to invest, undervaluing the health impact of doing it differently. And there are many parts of the country and parts of the world where that information would be applied readily and become a model for other places if we make the work available. Here we're just looking at the U.S. life expectancy at birth, 1970 to 2003. I have to update this, although the trajectories haven't changed much. And the point here is that the difference in life expectancy is not just biological. There's social factors going on. You wouldn't see a change in life expectancy over 23 years. I mean, people didn't evolve in that time range. There's really differences in the context that people live in. And it becomes more apparent as we look at the gaps cross-nationally. Here, when you look at the countries with the highest life expectancy, the gap is substantial in favoring women. Although it is not a linear relationship here, it's not dose response, if that's your language of choice. You'll see that compared to the U.S., Sweden has life expectancy more than 2 years longer, and that the gender difference is 1 year smaller. And that, in part, we would attribute, and we go into greater detail in our book, but we would attribute to differences in the social policies around men's and women's lives. Now, in other parts of the world, where there's the lowest life expectancy, let's see if I can get this to show up, there we go, people aren't living very long at all. The gap narrows, eliminates, or in very few cases, only a couple at any given point in time, reverses, where women are actually dying younger than men, and this is related to dying in childbirth and other issues related to nutrition. This is, to paraphrase Joanne Lynn, it's a case of equal opportunity mediocrity. This isn't a solution. It's part of the problem. And because I work better with maps than numbers, let me see if I can pull this up. Here you can see the pattern of the gender gap just in life expectancy, and I could do a range of these on other kinds of health outcomes, but just looking at life expectancy and the orange countries there, it's either favoring men or favoring by women by 1 year or less. These are places with very low life expectancy. The more golden color, it's 1 to 3. The gray areas are what we think of as women having a slight advantage. The green, which unfortunately does not stand out on this monitor, is most of Western Europe and most of South America. The gender advantage is much longer for women in those countries for a variety of reasons. And then kind of on the other extreme, when you look at the Soviet Union, Russia now and the former Eastern Bloc countries, you see an extreme female advantage. And this is partly related to alcohol problems, to extreme problems that happened partly fairly abruptly with the end of the Soviet Union. And before then, they would have fallen closer to that 6 to 9 range. But there are many things that happen in the world that affect the individual's opportunities to pursue health, and they operate in very gendered ways because of differences in our lives. The social explanations of differences in men's and women's health have actually, most of the work on social explanations is focused on SES. This, as the work came out 20 or 30 years ago, establishing that there's a gradient even in the middle income, the Whitehall studies, Marmot's work, much of this is wonderful stuff showing that how much you earn matters. They're not just a couple of social class groups, but those with more live longer and for the most part do better. This work's focused on how SES is related to exposure to negative and positive factors, to risk, to vulnerability, to resilience, in addition to planning and your coping style. It's also related to the kinds of social relationships. Now, social relationships become even more important as you start to look at gender when you're looking in the developed world, because women have larger, more diverse social networks, and their support involves more social and emotional and instrumental giving within that network. Also, women experience more negative effects, more psychological negative effects of the bad things that have happened in their social network. The extreme case being a study that interviewed husbands and wives about the stresses in the past year. And the women would often report, well, you know, one of the worst things was my husband's mother died. And it wouldn't necessarily show up on his list of the very draining things that happened in the past year. And that partly has to do with differences in our lives that go beyond the pure socioeconomic, that go beyond the important, but in much of the world less critical now, aspects of pure discrimination and economic inequality, and get at the kinds of role combinations, the kinds of differences in caregiving across generations, now with people living longer, sometimes across many generations, and the risk of social isolation. Women are far more likely to be widowed in old age. Women are far more likely to be living alone and poor, and this is part of where you get back into the SES issues of having a very long life expectancy means when you have policies that deal with older men and women, that are explicitly treat them the same. You may completely avoid saying we're going to treat men one way and we're going to treat women another way. But if there are different, huge differences in their lives, and there are because women live longer and because women tend to marry men who are older, and so they tend to spend more of their retirement widowed, and they tended to have had lower incomes in the first place, you can have a simple policy like cost of living adjustments and Social Security that says we treat everybody the same, and treating everybody the same results in a lot of women in poverty who had worked for their whole lives. Additional aspect out of the social science literature is looking at this continuum from personality traits to more mutable factors in coping to coping resources and availability, and how men and women cope and whether or not they're engaging in positive health behaviors in doing so, or resorting to very negative health behaviors that may help in the moment, but not in the day or the week, and certainly not over the years. So we would argue that inequality does not explain the differences. Clearly, life at the top isn't just better, it's longer, and status itself confers many benefits, and we can show this within and between countries. But this relative advantage or disadvantage is not enough to explain differences in men's and women's health. And part of the reason we wanted to look at men's and women's health is it's clear there is a biological component as well as a social component, and that a social model could explain female disadvantage and women getting sick more, but then that can't explain women living longer. Or a model that focuses on biological advantages for women can't explain why they live longer. And we would argue that this integration is necessary to do a better job of understanding racial and ethnic disparities among men and among women and more broadly. On the biological side, and these conversations still happen far too much separately. But on the biomedical side, the work is focused on the advantages that accrue through physiological systems, the hormonal differences that appear to be beneficial for women, at least in the short run, at least in shifting the curve on cardiovascular disease. Immune function. As you may or may not know, men's and women's immune functions operate somewhat differently, and this is true across almost all species, where females have much more stronger antibody responses to a foreign antigen, and that's whether you gave them a vaccine or they have exposure naturally in the course of life. This is helpful in that having a high level of onboard passive immunity is protective when your immune system partially ramps down in pregnancy so that it's conveyed on to an infant, and also when breastfeeding. A tremendous amount of the immune protection is conveyed through breastfeeding. This has a double-edged sword. It's not necessarily a better way, it's just a different way. And it may be largely responsible for women's greater risk of autoimmune disorders because that being farther on that end of the continuum. Certainly there's sex-specific and sex-linked diseases that matter. And put men at more risk. And most of these arguments follow under the idea of biological evolution, that there would be selection towards advantage. But it doesn't get at the integration between social and biological. So what's missing is that this need to integrate, that if inequality alone can't explain the paradox, that the disciplines all too often proceed separately, and that many questions remain. So what do we need to gain a better understanding of gender differences? Well, we need a comprehensive social framework that incorporates contextual effects on health, individual choice and responsibility, and the interaction between social and biological processes. And this is where the figure that Shakay handed out for you comes in. It's a schematic of the framework of choice. And so the individual is making decisions, but those decisions, many of them aren't made all by themselves. We make decisions in concert with issues around our workplace and the accommodations we make to them in scheduling and otherwise, around our family, around the communities that we live in that make decisions about air quality and transportation and public safety and so on, and broader social policies. And these things play out in terms of the individual choices, in terms of the stress response an individual has, and ultimately their health outcomes. Now, the links between choice constraints and an accumulative income impact on health happen through all of these categories: the jobs and careers we pursue, marriage, family, children, neighborhood housing, how we use our income, how we convey intergenerational support. But even as individuals, we don't have information about the health consequences of those decisions. It'd be entirely possible to have information in the Dictionary of Occupational Titles when you're advising people on choosing careers that said something about what you'd need to accommodate along with a specific kind of career in terms of coping and lifestyle, for example, or what you would need to do when you make decisions like this around the family. What else do you need to do to maximize the health of the members? But we don't put that information out there for the individual, through public health, or more broadly. Now, these decisions and actions by the families, communities, and governments shape men's and women's choices and opportunities. They impact their stress levels and their exposure to risks, and I think that's all very obvious to all of us through the workplace and the kind of work-family conflict and spillover that happens. And they also create incentives or disincentives for engaging in health behaviors, and sometimes it's entirely unintended. It's entirely oblivious. But these are the kinds of levers that we have an opportunity to explore and use as leverage points in intervening to improve health. So we argue that people construct choices from their priorities and values, that their choices are constrained by the context they live in and by the meanings that culturally and individually or through their peer groups apply to what those actions and decisions are. And we have a lot of illustrations of this through promoting safe sex and what that means to individuals to be prepared to be safe, but it applies in so many other domains in our understanding of what it is to fulfill the role of mother or daughter or father and the priorities we make for ourselves and for our children. So we need to understand that rational people make decisions that don't always maximize their health. And thus, we would argue that the possible contexts that we could be intervening on, that we could be informing about the health effects of everyday life, include the policy regime level on many of the policies that aren't explicitly health or healthcare policies, on the community level in the design and housing and structure of community life, and on the work environment, so that health-conscious decisions could be made at all of these levels. Just in closing, I wanted to say that these matter because the gender differences are distinct and go beyond the models that have worked for understanding racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic disparities. That the knowledge gaps that we have are hampering intervening and improving women's health and in improving men's health. And that we need to understand how to create health consciousness in decision making at all of these levels in order to have a platform of prevention, to have policies that actually are directed towards having healthy workforces, healthy population. And thank you.